Now, having reviewed these arguments for constitutionalism in this lecture and the arguments for absolutism in the previous lecture, I think it's only fair to say at this point that a lot of these arguments for absolutism and for constitutionalism probably seem a bit strange to the modern mind. They're not proofs, after all. They don't proceed from shared fundamental assumptions, and they don't rigorously demonstrate their conclusions. And this is especially true, it seems to me, of the doctrine of inferior magistrates. If we want to subject that doctrine to an unsympathetic reading, we could say, well, this is really nothing more than saying the high officials of the crown, if they feel they have good cause, can oppose the will of the monarch. But it seems to me that these arguments are less important for the rigor of their logic than for the worldview that they advance. And this is, again, especially true of inferior magistrates. It's a vision in which the important people of the kingdom, you must have some kind of right of correcting a monarch who's gone so far. Finally, and this is a theme to which we will return again and again in the lectures that follow, for all of these theorists, whether they're Neo-Thomists or whether they're Lutherans or whether they're radicals of one kind or another, the right of resistance is never grounded in an objection to the distribution of power in society. It's never an argument about there's too much power at the top and not enough power at the bottom, along the lines of modern liberal democratic arguments. It's never an argument, if you want to think of it this way, about the form of the state. It's always an argument about the uses to which power is being put, that is to say, about the ends of the state. You'll never find a 16th century theorist saying that the king has to be deposed if the peasants don't have a say. What he will say is the king has to be deposed if he's not, if he's violating the fundamental laws of religion or the fundamental laws of the kingdom or this kind of a thing. So if the power of polity is being put to the wrong uses, then, and only then, can it be resisted. Having then concluded our discussion of political theory, I would like to provide a brief summary of the political context in Europe in the immediate background to the wars of religion. And here, the conflict that we need to look at is the so-called Habsburg-Valois struggle, which is conventionally dated between 1494 and 1559. It gets that name because it represents a struggle for power between two dynastic houses, the House of Valois, which was the French crown, and the House of Habsburg, which was the crown of Spain. These wars, which are confusing, and for that reason we won't go into them in too much detail, consisted of a series of French attempts to conquer Italy, invariably unsuccessful in the end, plus a collection of attacks and counterattacks along other parts of the French frontier in an effort by the two sides to influence the outcome of the conflict in Italy. Now, the fact that the conflict was inconclusive doesn't mean it had no historical consequence. It brought all kinds of Italian cuisine to France. Before the Habsburg-Valois struggle, French cooking was extremely boring, and the culinary pride that the French now have about their own cooking is actually a legacy of the 16th and 17th centuries forward. But instead of going through this blow by blow, I'd like to offer a couple of observations about the structure of this conflict and what it presages for the centuries that follow. The first essential point, it's a somewhat vulgar point, but nonetheless is essential, is that France is the 800-pound gorilla of Europe. That is to say, France is by far the most powerful state in all of Europe, and everybody knows this. A lot of this comes from population alone. In the year 1500, the figures are never precise, but France has a population of roughly 16 million people. Spain at this time has fewer than 7, and England at this time has fewer than 3. And more people means more recruits, it means more taxes, more revenues, and therefore more power. I should add as a footnote that although the Holy Roman Empire slash Germany had a population of about 12 million and Italy had a population of about 10 million at this time, the fact that Germany and Italy were politically fragmented meant that those numbers didn't translate into political power, leaving only one polity to claim the guerrilla title. Now, whereas France had been paralyzed by the Hundred Years' War with England in the 14th and the 15th centuries, from the later 15th century forward, France is getting much, much more powerful. Perhaps it's becoming a 900-pound gorilla. And there are two key aspects to the recovery of France. One of them is a kind of internal recovery. The crown begins to absorb many of the semi-independent fiefdoms, also called appanage, which had pervaded France. Normandy, for example, is absorbed in 1450, conquered from the English. Guienne in southwestern France is again conquered from the English in 1453. Provence in southeastern France is absorbed in 1481, Brittany in northwestern France is absorbed in 1491, so that the part of France where the king is the unquestioned power is becoming much larger in the 15th century.